Morning, Mr. Sachs. You can fire when ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Benjamin Sachs, registration number 11034. I'm appearing on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Ms. Franz. May it please the court. The central issue, there are a number of issues that are raised in the brief, but the issue I want to focus on is what I believe to be the central issue in this case, which is whether evidence of the doctor's apology was entirely prohibited by the I'm sorry statute enacted in Colorado, I think in 2003. The plaintiff is asking the court to hold that I'm sorry statements should be excluded by the statute in their entirety, such as statements that were offered in this case. They were elicited on cross-examination of the plaintiff. They were not offered as part of the direct testimony of Ms. Franz, and there were additional statements that were listed from the defendant, Dr. Forshner. Now, we think that the statute, which has never before been construed by this court, is really an unambiguous, clear statute that provides a broad exclusionary rule and a broad exclusionary principle, and that the trial court actually correctly construed the statute in the first instance when there was a motion in limine that had been presented by Dr. Forshner.
Mr. Sachs, if we construe the apology statute in the manner that you're suggesting, what is the purpose of the language as evidence of an admission of liability or as evidence of an admission against interest? Because the inclusion of that language seems to restrict somewhat the application of the statute.
Well, that's true, and I think that the court, you're correct, because I think implicitly what you're saying is that words that are used in a statute can't be regarded as superfluous or unnecessary. And the same could be true of rules of evidence that this court has construed, like Rule 408 and Rule 411, that has prohibited uses. And then it more explicitly than this I'm sorry statute goes into permitted uses of evidence. Now, the real question in this case is, when you're dealing with I'm sorry statements like those in this case, are there any proper uses of that evidence at all?
Well, that's a different question, and it's a fair one, but the issue of relevance is not here before us. I mean, I could have understood a pretty strong argument with how this is relevant, but I don't think that's presented to us.
Well, it is presented to you because what the argument is that is presented by the defendant in their answer brief is specifically that there were two particular purposes why this was offered. And, you know, those are set forth in page 17 and page 22.
Sure, but they were responding that there, I think that comes in the context of them saying it was not evident, offered as an admission of liability or an admission against interest. It was offered for a different purpose. I think that's the only reason they're making that argument. You're our appellant, obviously, and I don't think you've said the court, well, I'm sure you didn't argue the court shouldn't have let it in on relevance grounds. Your argument is as you presented it.
Well, Your Honor, that's because the proponent of the evidence in this case had to make an argument that it was relevant evidence and it was admissible under 401, 402, and 403, or that it was admissible under 404 or 608. And those arguments don't appear either. So the proponent of the evidence has some initial burden of proof to establish the basis for the admissibility of these I'm sorry statements.
Did Ms. Franz object to the evidence on those grounds at trial?
Ms. Franz did object that there was no proper purpose for the I'm sorry statements other than to establish that Dr. Forshner was trying to show that by his I'm sorry statements that he never admitted conduct that would amount to negligence. So essentially, one of the issues that I think you have to address in determining the proper application of this statute is there a distinction between fault admitting statements of a doctor and mistake admitting statements of a doctor when both are apologies, when both contain expressions of apology or expressions of compassion or sympathy or benevolence or any of the other expressions that are recounted in the I'm sorry statute.
So this isn't like something along the lines of subsequent remedial measures, which can't come in as an admission of liability, and yet can't they come in for other purposes? I don't know that it was possible to fix the railing on the deck or whatever.
If the proponent of the evidence makes a proper showing that there's a proper purpose for that evidence and identifies that proper purpose, and it's consistent with the purposes of the exclusionary provisions. So we don't believe that the proponent of the evidence in this case ever made that kind of showing and didn't explain any basis in the rules of evidence for these I'm sorry statements coming into evidence. So that's one distinction, is the distinction between fault admitting expressions of apology and mistake admitting. And we think that for purposes of applying the statute, that is a mistaken distinction without a difference. Now, the second distinction which could apply here is that, well, there's a difference between evidence showing that the doctor made an admission that he had engaged in negligent conduct and the absence of any admission that he had engaged in negligent conduct. The truth is that the statute in this case says that essentially evidence relating to the issue of whether the doctor made a statement that constitutes an admission of liability or failed to do so, it's the same thing for purposes of the statute. Evidence either way should be inadmissible for purposes of applying the statute. So it shouldn't be an adequate answer to you that it's a proper, it's not prohibited because he made a mistake admitting expression of apology and not a fault admitting expression of apology, or that he was really trying to show the absence of any admission that he had engaged in negligent conduct. For purposes of the statute, all of those expressions are prohibited expressions. So all that remains is, well, what other proper purpose would there be for these statements? And, you know, again, we think that the purpose is revealed in the answer brief. Excuse me. Page 17, the defendant argues that it was necessary to introduce this evidence to rebut the implication left by questions asked by plaintiff's counsel that Dr. Forshner had intentionally stapled plaintiff's urine. The first suggestion on page 17 is that it's necessary to rebut the implication that this was intentional conduct to purposely staple Ms. Franz's urine. Well, if you examine the evidence, there's no such implication. That's imaginary. There was no implication from the evidence that there was intentional conduct. There were no allegations and there was no proof.
But again, I'm struggling a little bit, Mr. Sachs. I do understand your argument, but I'm just not sure this was ever made at trial. I mean, the problem here, so let me, what's presented to us is, what does this statute mean and what's the limits of it? Would you agree that, forget about whether there was evidence to support their argument, if their argument is they want to put on this evidence to rebut an allegation of intentional conduct, or they want to rebut it to, or they want to put on this evidence to rebut a suggestion that the doctor was heartless, which I could see in this case, you know, also, isn't that a reason other than an admission of liability or an admission against interest? Isn't that at least two areas where this evidence could come in consistent with the statute?
Yes, I would agree, but, and it's an important but, that it's like, I'm sorry, but.
That's why we're here.
The reason is that the proponent of this evidence, that at least on its face, is prohibited and should be excluded, has some burden to show the court the purpose for which the evidence is offered. And unless the proponent of the evidence makes that showing, it's not enough just to say, but I'm not offering it for any prohibited purpose, I'm offering it for some other legitimate purpose, just trust me. you know, there was no showing by the proponent of this evidence that that was, in fact, the purpose or that those purposes were consistent with the rules of evidence. There, that's why these two briefs, these two portions of the brief, focus on proffered rationalizations to try to convince you that it was necessary to rebut some imagined evidence that had been put on by the plaintiff. And an examination of the record should reveal to you that that wasn't evidence that was presented by the plaintiff. So it wasn't an appropriate purpose to try to rebut this imagined evidence. It was injecting this into the case improperly.
Can you point us to any place in the record where you said, I object, there's no grounds for that? Well, I mean, I do see a whole lot of objections on your part. This is not admissible. It doesn't come into the statute. I see a whole lot of that. I'm having trouble, and I may just not be remembering, so push back. Is there some place in the record where you say the evidence does not support this inference? That's a bunch of malarkey. Well, words to that effect.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that Ms. Brown did make arguments to that effect, that there is no proper purpose for, you know, for this evidence to come in. So, was there an objection, Rule 403, objection, Rule 402? Unfortunately, I can't point you to it.
As long as we're talking about what's in the record, can I digress a moment? You made an argument on a judicial estoppel theory, and in the answer brief, we're told that we can't address this because it wasn't preserved for appellate review. Obviously, it was brought up in the new trial motion. Do you recall whether at any point before that new trial motion, judicial estoppel was argued?
Well, the principles, the concept of judicial estoppel was certainly argued because throughout the record, and it's described in the preservation of the evidence portion, there were references to the court's prior rulings on this. So to the extent that judicial estoppel can only exist if there is a prior ruling on a motion for which the party to be estopped successfully made an argument, that's certainly in the record. I would admit to you, Judge Vogt, that the words judicial estoppel were actually argued in the motion for post-trial relief. So I'm going to reserve the remainder of my time.
You may. Thank you, Mr. Sachs. Good morning, Mr. Yoon.
Good morning. My name is David Yoon. My registration number is 23448. I have the privilege of representing defendant, appellee, Dr. David Forshner. The issue on appeal, as the court mentioned, is whether the trial court properly admitted evidence that Dr. Forshner apologized under CRS 1325-135. This court reviews trial court's evidentiary rulings for abuse of discretion unless that ruling is manifestly arbitrary, unreasonable, or unfair. This court cannot disturb it. There are multiple reasons why this court should not disturb the trial court's ruling. I just want to address three points for today. That is that plaintiff did not preserve her objection at trial. Two, CRS 1325-135 does not support plaintiff's interpretation. And three, that the evidence of apology was harmless. And I will, unless the court has questions, I will rest on the other issues that were discussed in our answer brief.
I don't know if the judicial estoppel issue is subsumed within your first statement about not being preserved.
Yes.
But help me out on this, because obviously it was raised in the new trial motion and the court ruled on it. Is that the sort of objection, if you will, that has to be made at the time evidence is being brought in? For example, some objections, you waive them if you don't raise it at the moment of the evidence. Would you have to jump up and say objection, judicial estoppel, in order to preserve this argument for appellate review?
Yes, Your Honor. For any evidentiary objection, you have to do it before trial or at the time of trial before the evidence is introduced so that the trial court has an opportunity to rule on that particular argument. And otherwise, you get a verdict and they didn't even make the argument that this evidence should be not admitted.
Okay, but isn't it enough if you're saying, wait, they're trying to have it both ways with a statement, or you've already ruled this way and now you're ruling this way? Isn't that kind of raising the concept without using the magic words judicial estoppel?
Well, let me go back to what the trial court did. There was, and I want to also address Judge Gabriel's argument, point about relevancy. Plaintiff did not preserve her argument with respect to relevancy, much less the statute or the judicial estoppel doctrine. And let me explain why. As the court knows, in order to preserve an evidentiary ruling, you must generally make a contemporaneous objection when the evidence is offered. Although a motion in limine in some circumstances preserve that issue, it doesn't preserve it when the trial court says, you know what, I'm going to have to hear the evidence come in and I'm going to reserve ruling until you offer it. And in this case, that's precisely what the trial court did. First of all, the plaintiff never filed a motion in limine at all. We filed a motion in limine on the apology evidence for very limited purpose, that the plaintiff should be precluded from introducing that evidence to establish liability. And our reply, in fact, says we intend to reserve our right to present it for other purposes if it comes up. So that's clear. And in fact, after the pretrial hearing, the plaintiff's counsel is still confused about it, so asked for clarification. Your Honor, is the apology evidence coming in or not on the first day of trial? And the court says, I can't rule on that until the evidence actually is introduced and the parties please come to the bench and make your objection at that time.
Well, the court first said it's out. Then you all reminded the court that right in our reply brief, we said we're reserving our right to enter it. And the court says, okay, well, we'll see how it comes out and I'll want to hear about relevance. I think the court specifically referred to that. But let me, just on this point, how does that, I mean, the plaintiff side here did repeatedly refer to the statute. And I recognize they did not file it. They said, we agree with the motion in limine when you first filed it. But then repeatedly in bench conferences, they said, this doesn't come in under the statute. Why isn't that enough to preserve their argument, at least about the statute?
Well, that was a pretrial hearing, Your Honor. They did raise the statute at the pretrial hearing, but on the morning of trial, the court said, come approach the bench and make your objection at that time. And when that time came up, Mr. Miller came up to the bench and said, I would like to ask Ms. Franz question about the phone call that was made. And claims counsel at that time never said the evidence should be excluded. She said, you know what it's going to do? If you're going to introduce that evidence, it's going to open the door to the argument that Dr. Forstner made a mistake. And Mr. Miller said, that's fine. And the court said, it's coming in. At no time did they say it's not relevant. No time did they say it should be excluded under 403. No time did they mention the statute, or no time did they say the judicial estoppel doctrine applies.
Mr. Yoon, just to the extent that the plaintiff's taking a hard line interpretation of the statute, saying that it's an apology is absolutely inadmissible, didn't their objection at the pretrial stage preserve that? Or are you saying that by pointing out that there's a possibility of opening the door, that they somehow abandoned that earlier objection?
I'm saying they abandoned their objection because the court said, make your objection when the evidence is introduced. And when I think what
wasn't
the trial
that as to relevance,
says,
though? Pardon? Make your objection as to relevance when it's introduced, but does that abandon the position that the statute strictly precludes?
I read the court's ruling to say not only relevance, but to whether you're deciding whether to proceed or not. And in fact, the trial court made that finding in the order denying the plaintiff's motion for a new trial. The court specifically said, plaintiff did not object to this evidence on the basis of the statute and indeed attempted to capitalize on his mission by seeking to introduce evidence that defendant admitted that he made a mistake, which the court allowed. He's describing what occurred at the bench conference. So we submit that they did not preserve their objection on relevance or the statute or judicial estoppel. Now, he says, Mr. Sachs says, we have to make some sort of prima facie finding why it's relevant. Evidence comes in all the time in trials, and if they don't object to it, it's asked and it goes forward. And there was never, not even in the pretrial hearing, in fact, on appeal, saying this evidence should have been inadmissible under relevancy ground. Now the statute, I think Judge Horace pointed out, their interpretation of the statute would render the language superfluous. The language that's talking about that it is inadmissible as evidence of liability or as evidence of admission against interest. If the legislature wanted to exclude the evidence for all purposes, it could have just ended the paragraph by saying it's inadmissible, period, and left the language out about the qualifying language. But that's not what the legislature did. The legislature made it clear that it's inadmissible for purposes of proving liability or as an admission against interest. So plaintiff's interpretation would, in effect, rewrite the statute. So we submit that their interpretation is erroneous. And Your Honor, you pointed out the reason we offer the evidence our brief is referring to why it wasn't offered to prove liability or as an admission against interest. It wasn't a statement that it was relevant or anything else, and they didn't preserve that argument. Now,
ask you, Mr. Yoon, if I can. I fully understand your argument that Ms. Franz did not preserve the relevance objection. What was the relevance of this evidence here?
Your Honor, throughout the trial, they said Dr. Forshner intentionally looked at the uterus and identified it and stapled it. And if you just look at their opening brief, it says on page 4, if you're looking at the uterus, this is their opening brief, at the uterus, it's not your plan to staple it, you shouldn't staple it, agreed? If you're looking at the uterus, it's not your plan. Yes, you should avoid stapling the uterus. Next page, page 5, it says, it's talking about Dr. Forshman had plenty of time to avoid the uterus. The whole page is talking about that. The next page is talking about how Dr. Forshner was able to see the staples. And then there's a question. You told me that you identified the uterus before engaging the stapler. Yes, and you should have avoided it. Once you identified the uterus, you should have been able to avoid it. Yes. So all those questions were designed to say he committed some sort of intentional act.
Aren't those all just designed to show negligence? I mean, I was listening for something that would suggest intent in the passages that you read, and I didn't hear.
Well, I think it said more than just negligence. Throughout the case, they were saying he actually looked at it and intentionally stapled it. And then there was also testimony by Mrs. Franz that after the procedure, Dr. Forshner never called her to see how she was doing. So from our point of view, the implication was he was an uncaring physician who intentionally stapled her uterus. So we thought that it was appropriate to rebut that insinuation.
And Ms. Franz testified that she was never called before the evidence of the apology came in?
It came in. I think it came in first initially through Ms. Franz, and then the testimony came out, but certainly before Dr. Forshner testified.
But Ms. Franz testified before any of the apology came in. Ms. Franz testified he never called me before it came in.
I believe it's actually her testimony about the apology comes in. There's a question about the no phone call, and then Dr. Forshner testifies further.
Okay, so the apology came in before Ms. Franz said he didn't call me.
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, I need to address the last point because I think it is the most important point, which is harmless error doctrine. Even assuming, arguing that it was error to admit the evidence, that evidence was harmless. Plaintiff cannot establish that the evidence substantially influenced the outcome of the case or the basic fairness of the trial. First, the truth is that the evidence apology actually helped plaintiff's case far more than it helped Dr. Forshner's case. Plaintiff's counsel argued in closing that the apology, in combination with the admission of a mistake, was an admission of negligence, and plaintiff's counsel said, quote, he told Mrs. Franz that he made a mistake. A mistake is an error, and that's what negligence is. It's making a mistake. Plaintiff's counsel then went on to say, saying sorry is not enough. Dr. Forshner needs to take responsibility. Therefore, plaintiff can hardly claim that they were prejudiced or denied a fair trial when she was able to capitalize on this evidence as an admission of negligence. And second, plaintiff's counsel says that the evidence apology engenders sympathy for Dr. Forshner. And that cannot possibly be true because the court instructed the jury that it must not be influenced by sympathy, bias, or prejudice for or against any party. Given that this court must presume that the jury followed the instruction, this court must also presume that the jury verdict could not have been tainted by any sympathy for Dr. Forshner. And lastly, the testimony concerning the apology probably took less than a few minutes in a week-long trial. There was substantial evidence presented by both parties about whether or not Dr. Forshner was negligent. The jury agreed with our argument that Dr. Forshner met the standard of care, and I think it would ignore reality and the evidence presented to say that this testimony that took up probably less than 5 minutes influenced the outcome of the case. For all those reasons, we submit that this court should affirm the trial court's judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Yoon. Mr. Sachs, you've got about 2 minutes and 30, actually you have exactly 2 minutes and 34 seconds.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Yoon, in his argument, refers to statement in the order denying motion for new trial in which Judge Elliff said that plaintiff did not object to the admission of this evidence on the basis of the statute. That's erroneous. But more importantly, when this was first raised, it was raised by the defendant, and the defendant objected, and the court's ruling was apologies are out. So, and the basis of that motion in limine was the I'm sorry statute. So it's really fanciful to say that there was no objection or that the court wasn't alerted to the applicability of this statute. That is really a harsh and unnecessary interpretation or application of the rules governing preservation of error for purposes of appeal. The purpose of the contemporaneous objection rule is simply to alert the trial court that an error may have been made and to provide the court with an opportunity to immediately correct erroneous rulings. And to address a point that, or a question that Judge Vogt made, there's a case, Barrow versus Springer versus Steinberg, in which this court in 2010 said, to preserve an issue for appeal, all that's needed is that the issue be brought to the attention of the trial court and the court be given an opportunity to rule on it. No talismanic language is required to preserve an issue. So that addresses her issue of, was it necessary for the plaintiff to use the magic words, judicial estoppel, then and there? And the answer is no. Those magic words weren't necessary. All that was necessary is to say, as Ms. Brown did, that this court has previously ruled on this issue. And you know, the court has previously ruled at the request of the defendant that this evidence should be inadmissible, that I'm sorry evidence should be inadmissible. At the time of that initial ruling, I think it's important to bear in mind that there was other evidence of conduct, including payments that were made under COPIC's 3R program, that was also sought to be excluded and which was excluded, And the court maintained that ruling and prohibited the plaintiff from even going into any 3R's evidence or evidence of payments made by or on behalf of the defendant in this case that would have revealed essentially more of an acknowledgement of fault or responsibility, at least arguably. So you know, there's no question that this was an opportunistic and strategic decision made by the defendant for the purpose of securing an advantage in a case involving close questions of liability. And they did, in fact, secure an advantage. So we ask you to reverse and remand the case for a new trial.
Thank you, Mr. Sachs. We thank you, and we thank you, Mr. Yun, for your very helpful arguments today. I know you both are here a lot. It's always a pleasure to have both of you in our court. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes our 9 o'clock docket. And